Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hello and welcome to Old Brother, a podcast about Salford / Manchester's legendary musical institution, The Fall. You can find us at Spotify, Apple and all the usual suspects, but we're hosted at play.acast.com/s/Old Brother. All episodes are also available on YouTube. Just search for Old Brother Podcast and subscribe so you'll never miss an episode. This week we're joined by Mr. John Robb, who discusses goth, bass playing, his writing and of course his fascinating interactions with The Fall. Hope you enjoy it.
Right, here we are then, the latest edition of Old Brother, with me, Paul, and my brother Steve, for the purpose of the tape. Afternoon, Steve.
Hello, afternoon.
You well?
I'm okay, thanks, yeah.
Good.
Are you?
I'm very well, thank you, yes. I don't know why we do this, because it's not like, you know, we haven't spoken before or switched the tape on.
No.
There is an actual tape either, but you know what I mean. You know why I'm going with this. Anyway. We're joined today, but I'm just saying, if he's got any questions, he might want to try dabbling in the world of interviewing as well, because I'm sure he'd be good at it if he ever did it. We've got the author, musician, entrepreneur, TV star, curator of Louder Than Words, Mr. John Robb. How are you, John? You all right?
I'm all right.
Hello.
It did sound like you read that off a piece of paper, actually.
I didn't read that. I made that up as I went along.
That's what I did. In fact, you can sum up all those jobs as making up as you go along. Yeah.
Did I miss anything out? No, I don't think so, did I?
Probably, yeah.
Probably.
We can find out.
Fashion guru.
Yeah, that's better. Let's start with that, yeah. Wildlife expert. The interesting stuff,
yeah. So, I don't know if you've listened to the podcast before, but basically we're going to go through your experiences with and history with The Fall. Now, in your case, it goes back quite a long way, doesn't it?
Oh, a real long way, yeah. We're back to Blackpool, which is where I'm from. So, as I said, every now and then, I had to correct somebody this morning. He said, oh, you've got a really strong Manchester accent. I said, I haven't got a Manchester accent at all. I still got a Lancashire accent. I mean, Blackpool.
I think you're right, yeah.
Blackpool doesn't really have a very discernible accent. It's not like Preston or Burnley or Blackburn, but it doesn't, or it didn't used to have a Manchester accent, but it's got one now. Anyway, so.
I think there's a bit of that, but I think it's getting a bit ubiquitous now, the Manchester accent, isn't it? I think there's only people like holding out.
It's sort of invading. In fact, the Manchester accent's probably stronger in places like Blackpool than it is with people your age who are from Manchester, which is kind of odd as well, isn't it? So anyway, there I was in Blackpool as a teenage punk rocker. We had the band The Membranes at the time, and we felt incredibly isolated because, I mean, we were friends with all of the bands of the scene. It was a good scene in Blackpool. I mean, it was Section 25 from Blackpool to this day, I think.
Yeah.
An amazing band, Joy Division, really amazing band. And Ian Curtis thought that as well. He used to be around their house every week. We didn't even know that, you know, But that's the time in Joy Division weren't U2, as we all remember as well. They were a small band, weren't they? They played Blackpool to about 80 people, you know. I mean, if you meet people now in Russia who a massively huge, Joy Division, a big spot, never in Russia. They in their heads, they think they're like a stadium band. Oh, they're so popular there, enormous. Yeah. Yeah. I met a Fall fan there once. Yeah.
Well, man, I always reckon the Fall were big in places like that because of John Peel's show on the World Service.
They were known to a circle of people, but Joy Division had gone through that into this. Just like virtually every band you meet in Russia is a massive Fall fan, and the influence is strong. I mean, it kind of chimes with their mentality, isn't it? Because it's dark and it's about death, and it's
yeah, see that.
They like that kind of thing, you know, that fatalism. Yes, we all die. You know, they're into that kind of thing there. So there we were. So, and there was other bands. There's a good scene of Blackpool bands, but we're super isolated. It's pre-internet. Going to Manchester was like a major expedition, you know, when no one had a car. Yeah. In fact, the first person who had a car, he's still around now, actually. He probably comments on your Facebook page every now and then. Mark Bursar, he's called. And he had a car. Yeah. And it was amazing. Wow. It's like we actually knew somebody roughly our age who had a car who liked the music we liked. So he would drive us to gigs in Manchester. But before all that happened, we were like any isolated small town kind of bunch of music heads. John Peel was the portal, wasn't it? And I remember him playing at the Fall's first release. And in fact, the first time we heard of the Fall was the Virgin compilation. I think a lot of people thought that what a valuable record to be on. And that last order is half past 10. We thought that was incredibly funny. It became like a little catchphrase for ages. And and we really like the track. The track's great. Great bass line.
It's a great album, that, actually. The Joy Division track. I think they were a bit embarrassed, but I mean the Rudolph S bit's a bit embarrassing. But but that and the thingy were on there, and the Steel Pulse was two Steel Pulse songs, and John Cooper Clark, which I still think were amongst his finest recordings, the two songs he did on there.
It's an amazing record, isn't it? You know, like you say, every track on is good, and it was a portal. It's something that's really interesting going on. And that's the first time I think we probably read about the Fall before that, because people you can read fanzines, but there was stuff will come in from Manchester, like these exotic things from the big city, you know, like. And then.
Four bits of paper.
So we read.
But I mean, it's funny, that, isn't it? Perception, because whatever Manchester was then, it certainly exotic wasn't a word you could use about Manchester then.
Yeah. It was exotic for us. I mean, people used to think Blackpool was exotic, and that wasn't exotic to us. But now when I go back and look at the Illuminations, I think they're mind-blowing. But at the time, we thought they were a bit of a drag. You know, we think, why would everyone come look at this bunch of more rubbish? But of course, when you don't live there, it's suddenly like it's more amazing. So to us, Manchester was this exotic music city full of people doing really cool stuff, making music. That was kind of like what we were trying to do, but we were sort of stuck on our own, really. Because the thing about Section 25 was they were like really old. They were 25.
Oh, wow.
We were 16. You know, there was a gap, a big gap. You know, they must have been annoying little children. And we looked at them as being like these wise old men, you know, from the hills or something.
Yeah.
So we got
your fanzine then, John? Was it Rocks, the little fanzine?
Yeah, I started that in 1978. We did that and we printed 50 of them and sold around Blackpool. It was amazing that everybody actually even bought it. But it was, and then we actually did another little sub fanzine where we did something about the school, and the school went to this big meltdown, thought there was an anarchist cell in the school and kicked it out. It seems happening like nowadays, you know, what the stuff that people do nowadays compared to them. You know, it's so naive and quite an innocent time, really, you know. So we did that. And then I remember with the Fall's early singles, so we really liked those. And then the album, I can't even remember the chronology now with the order of everything is, but the album was big with us. We used to play it over and over again because in punk, we were isolated. We didn't get in the right order, so we didn't actually do it the right way. So obviously we loved the Pistols and the Clash and the Buzzcocks inspiring because it's northern. So even though that felt like a long way away, you know, so it's inspiring the fact they've done their own records. Like, wow, you made your own record. But we also, because you have to put Magic Mushrooms into the equation because that's all there was to do. So we had a sort of weird psychedelic take of punk. So we completely loved the Stranglers because they were like a psychedelic punk band. So if you're getting that far, and then we loved XTC as well because they're kind of sort of odd and psychedelic. So the Fall to us weren't really, they didn't come to us from outer space. It didn't feel that far. It was just another version of that, but a more raggedy, looser version that we liked as well. and northern, and he sounded really northern, and he's very Magic Mushrooms. He had that kind of spooky, melancholic edge that Magic Mushrooms have. So that really, really connected with us, and I have listened to that record an awful lot on Magic Mushrooms.
Live at the Witch Trials.
Eh?
Live at the Witch Trials.
Yeah, even the sleeve. I really love the sleeve because it was so brutal and so odd and off kilter. But it totally made sense to us. I mean, we didn't know anything about the band. We didn't know what the band looked like. We didn't know why they were making music like this, but it didn't seem that far away from that world that we were sort of inhabiting musically, you know. And it wasn't. Yeah. And then we thought, God, they don't. I mean, we thought they don't sound like us, but they're in the same kind of weird space we're in, because we'd already made a record by then. We made two records. We're already doing our thing by then, but it wasn't as accomplished, you know. We couldn't play. I mean, who would you ask how to play musical instruments? There wasn't anybody, was there?
You couldn't get off YouTube.
No, you couldn't. We didn't know any chords or scales or that stuff. We just used to make it all up until we got it right, you know, and sort of, that sounds like a tune, that'll do, you know. And it was, and then when we heard the four, we thought that's like a slightly more grown-up version of what we're trying to do. I mean, obviously, Carl Burns drumming on that record is amazing, isn't it? It's like jazz drumming. And we didn't know anybody could drum like that, but...
I still don't.
That was amazing. All those Tom Rolls and stuff.
Yeah.
And the songs are really good. Rebellious Jukebox is what we really loved. And we loved the way he sang that. And it was, we thought it was funny as well. We kind of got the humour in it as well, and the darkness. And so it became that, and Metal Box was another record we loved at the time, so
that was something. Yeah. They were kind of a piece, weren't they?
Yeah.
That sort of.
All that stuff.
Injection of the ridiculous, you know, that sort of. It got very, very old very quickly, that punk sort of barcode-y. Apart from Buzzcocks, who pulled it off forever, didn't they? But once John Lydon went to Pill, and it all kind of opened out, I think.
We did. I never went off the simple punk stuff. I still liked it, but it didn't affect me in the same kind of way. You know, I like the energy of it, and the blast of energy and the intensity. To this day, I still like that. But I like the more psychedelic, off kilter stuff that was a bit weirder, that created these kind of odd atmospheres. Pills, very like that one. I mean, the first album, and Metal Box. I mean, I remember we'd go to the record shop in Cleveland, that's the nearest one to where we lived, to buy them. We're the only people that ever bought those records. And the guy behind the counter who sold them to us, Jeff Smith, now runs Radio 2. How bizarre is that?
Bloody hell.
I know. He's
still not playing them, though, is he?
No, he won't. Well, that's every time we put a record out, as a joke, I said it to him, say, play. He runs Radio 6 as well, actually. Say, can you play our stuff? And he goes, no. I said, it's your fault I sound like this. You're selling me all the punk records. You should have sold me ELO records.
Every time Jeremy Vine mentions The Fall on his Twitter, our Andrew, my brother, gets on to him saying, how come you never play on them? They're always banging on about them.
I know. It's not the thing that people always like the idea of what you do more than actually what you do.
I don't think Jeremy Vine gets much choice in what he plays on Radio 2, to be honest.
Whereas I think all of us, and probably a lot of people listen to this, we actually like the music. And that was always, for most people, that was the hardest part of the equation. They were, like the same with The Fall, people used to love the interviews and the persona and the idea of it. But when it came to the music, a lot of people got stuck. But for us, of course, it didn't sound weird at all. The Fall have always been fantastic pop bands, you know. Even the really obtuse songs were really catchy, you know. And a lot of that sort of bass playing that was going on from Brother Steve.
Yeah.
Let's have a bass conversation.
Moving quickly on. So when was the first time you saw the band live?
It was slightly later on. It was Norbrecht Castle in 1979, yes. I think it was. And the Norbrecht Castle was the venue where all the bands who came to Blackpool played. And everyone played there. It was really weird. Pretenders, Adam the Ants, Stray Cats. But it wasn't even in Blackpool. It was about 5 miles north of the town centre. They're off in London. You know, all these bands coming up to play Blackpool, which people didn't really do that much. Then you get to Blackpool, then you have to keep going. You think, where is this venue? And it's in this fake castle, like a hotel, looks like a fake castle on the prom. And it's just down the road from where we live, so we could walk up there. And the four were doing two shows. And this is the funniest thing. They did a matinee show in the afternoon for the under-60s, under-60s disco. Right, yeah. It was fantastic. All the audience was sat there.
That must have been one of my first gigs, I think.
Oh, was it? Oh, yeah, because were you playing then, or were you crewing? I can't remember.
Yeah.
You playing?
No, I was playing. Yeah, but yeah, we did the afternoon show.
I remember the first time I ever saw you, you were all walking down at the Prom together, like... towards the venue. You must have been out for a band walk or something really weird. Mark Smith had on, he had little Beatle crushes on and a black coat, and the rest of you looked taller than him and all walking along the Prom. We instantly recognised, because see, anybody looks slightly alternative and Blackpool stand out a mile. So he thought that must be the band, because I don't think even at that point we really knew what the four looked like. We just heard the records, and I think the second album was out by then as well, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So anyway, the gig was amazing. There was about us and about four of our mates going, wow, this is incredible. And these kids just like all hiding behind the chairs and the fingers in their ears. And then you played a show in the evening. So I don't know whoever thought of having a matinee show for the four, but it's either some of the great sense of humour.
It was nowhere near your first gig, Steve. According to this, it was in the November of 79. You'd done hundreds by then.
Well, in the grand scheme of things, it was one of them. Still early days, wasn't it?
It already felt like forever. But I remember, what's his name was on the drums.
Mike Lee. Yeah.
Yeah, it was a top bloke. And we spoke to him that day, and he's a really good guy. And when I started playing bass again, I put it on Facebook, I'm looking for a bass. And he got in touch after years, said, I've got your bass. If you want a bass, I've got one here. And he came around and sold me the Fender Precision I got. He said, this is exactly the bass you want. And as soon as I stood outside my
truck, I thought you were saying he sold you your bass.
No, that was a sad story, and that will come to that in a minute. But no, he sold me his soul. So anyway, I played it in the car park outside, and without him plugging it in, and he sounded amazing. I knew it was good. It's my favourite bass ever. It sounds fantastic, and he sold it to me.
You still got it?
I still, of course, I have. Yeah, yeah. It's mine. Well, I'll have that for the rest of my life. The other bass was that. Well, I used to have a violin bass because, being like little punk kids, I love I love Captain Sensible's bass on the back of the Damned album. Yeah. I didn't twig it was a Paul McCartney bass, even though I love the Beatles as well. But in them days, you didn't really see stuff. That it wasn't like you could dredge the internet. You knew the Beatles, what they looked like, but you didn't know what instruments they played, you know.
No.
So anyway, no. I thought, I want one of those, but obviously I can't buy one. When are you going to buy that at Blackpool? So I got a piece of wood and I carved a violin shape in it and got a Woolworths K bass, remember those? Took the neck off it and screwed it in and somebody put these DiMarzio pickups in. And somehow, by a complete fluke, it sounded amazing. It sounded like a landslide. It sounded like a Panzer tank. And it was all by mistake, but it's exactly the sound I wanted. And I had that bass about 15 years. And then when one night my flat got robbed in Manchester and all got nicked was my bag and that bass. And nobody else who lived in that shared house got anything nicked. I thought when they were running down the street with that bass, and they must go, what the fuck's that? And chucked it in the bin. Whereas for me, it was the best thing ever. You know, I would still use that to this day if I still had it. I was going to make, I might make another one at some point just because I really like the sound of it. I remember it was made out of maple wood, which someone told me once made the notes resonate more. Yeah. So that, I don't know, that must have been the lucky trick that made it sound so amazing. But we always loved basses. The bass was the king instrument in post-punk, wasn't it? I mean, of course, Steve, yeah. You could go get a cup of tea now, Paul.
Because I mean, you know, I always think that, you know, key to the Sex Pistols' success was Sid Vicious's bass player. I've always said so.
Well, Glenn Matlock.
I'll take that back, because the bass on Nevermind the Bollocks is fantastic. It's so, because you know, you hear Spunk and what have you with Glenn Matlock, and his bass lines are great, but they don't compare to Steve Jones just playing that sort of root note at the bottom. I think the bass on Nevermind the Box is absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, there's actually an interesting little subtopic here of great guitar players who were also great bass players. So most guitar players, when they play bass, they put loads of runs in it and ruin it, don't they? They don't realize it's actually just two or three notes can be super effective. But it can be complex and melodic as well. And I'll tell you the best guitar player, who's a really great bass player, is Captain Sensible. So when I saw the band play the other week, the original lineup at the Apollo, it was an amazing gig. You think, how can they be that good? And how come they were that good and fucked it all up so much?
I watched a bit of it, and what really struck me is how good Ratzkavis still is. He's incredible,
isn't he? When I interviewed him about 8 months ago, and he hadn't started rehearsing, I don't think they actually rehearsed as a band until about 2 weeks before the gigs.
Brian didn't look so well, did he?
He's all right, though. He's just had a hip replacement, so... Yeah, I've been in touch with him. He's okay. He's going to be... I always thought he was the oldest, but Captain's the oldest in the band.
Right.
Yeah, okay. I always thought Brian was about 4 years older just because he seemed to have been around a bit. And, you know, and he's... I remember Mick Jones once saying to me when I interviewed him that Brian was the first guy he ever met who knew what... You know, he's the first visionary who saw punk. You know, it's not flared trousers. It's short air, short songs, fast songs. And when he went to jam a London SS, he was kind of laughing at them because they all had long Mott the Hoople hair. Nothing wrong with that, because as the three of us here, Mott are gods in our world. But this is 4 years later, and Brian kind of saw the next phase. And and when he walked in the room, they're all looking at him, going, "Wow, he looks amazing."
He does as well. He looks like the sort of blueprint on the early damn pictures, don't he?
Oh, he looked great. He was like the cool one, like in the young ones. Yeah. There was like the cool one. Well, he was very much.
I think he's an amazing guitar captain, but he's never going to be anybody's cool member of the band, is he? Let's face it. You know,
he's kind of
cool in his nurse's uniform.
He's kind of cool in a different way, isn't he? Because he does carry it off. He's completely mad, but he does carry it off. Yeah. And he's a great guy. And also, what I was saying, he's an amazing bass player. He's super melodic. You know what made that gig really work? He played it with such joy. It wasn't like sometimes.
I thought that it was going to be a bit strained, you know, because certainly relationships between.
Yeah, but
Rat and the rest of the band have got a bit tasty at times, didn't they?
They did, but they were like, they looked like the biggest pals, and they're like having the greatest time of their lives. That's what made it really work.
That's nice.
And they played the second album, which I've always loved. I mean, no one else seems to like that album.
But you're the only person on earth who likes Music of Pleasure, aren't you?
Yeah, but I love it. It's an ace record. But
that bodes well, doesn't it, when you get all band members getting back together and they all get on all right, doesn't it?
They get on, yeah. That's cool. Nice.
There's a bunch of old lags in Manchester on that. And of course, I've not heard the album.
I believe so.
I've not heard the album officially. Officially, I've not heard the album. Brackets. It's really fucking good.
Well, thank you very much. So every now and again in this podcast, we give out a nugget of information, and the fall completists get really happy. So there's a thing on the fall discography here that says there were two shows on this day according to the tour schedule, but it's never been confirmed at Marlborough Castle, and you've just confirmed it that they did play two shows.
They did. I saw them both.
So the fall completists will be happy with that nugget of information anyway.
Anyway, I remember after that, so we went down to that gig, and me and Tills, who's the Ben Reds guitar player, we did a fanzine called Rocks, and this other guy who's in the band called Steve Farmery, without us knowing, had gone to the fall saying, "We can make our fanzine into the fall fanzine." And we go, what are you doing? That's not your fanzine. But from that, we got the fall's address, and we wrote a letter to them, because we scared such everybody, because it's a bit like Help, you know. How are we going to get out of Blackpool? How do you do it? It's impossible. And the fall wrote back a really long letter. Then we went over to Manchester, and we went to the Citation in Hume to meet Kay Carroll, who gave us this like 1 hour lecture on how to be in a band. pretty mad lecture. Wow. I won't repeat the whole conversation, but then they gave us some gigs, and that's how we got some early gigs with the fall. Yeah.
Nice.
So, some of it was, and some of it's unrepeatable.
Sounds great. Sounds all right.
I'm a bit more subtle than your old singer, so.
Well, I think the main advice for there would have been have a Kay Carroll, and then you can pretend to be a nice bloke, and she can be the Rottweiler behind you.
I mean, she was quite nice, actually, even though she was, there was a Rottweiler vibe to her. But some of the stuff she was saying wasn't what you would say was strictly PC, even then, let alone now.
We'll draw a veil on that. I've got to hear that you saw the fall over 100 times. Is that right, do you think?
Is it Headbar?
You've seen the fall 100 times?
I think I have, actually, yeah, because obviously we played the fall a lot, and also the fall would play a lot. So you would end up seeing them in so many places. When I seen the fall play Stoke Poly, I saw that there. I seen them all over Manchester. We did a tour of Scotland with the fall in 84, played Liverpool Warehouse with the fall in 88 or 81 or whatever it was. The old Poly place in Manchester, the right on building, whatever it's called, we played the fall there. Yeah.
What a great venue that was.
Oh, it was a really good venue. And I go past it every day going into town, and it reminds me of all those gigs. It's a really good space, wasn't it?
So go on then. What your experiences of supporting, were they good?
So yeah, there's one here. I've got here the 4th of November 1981 at the Gaiety Park in Blackpool with you and the Nightingales. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I remember it really well. It's a really odd venue because it was like a... what we would call Grockles, holidaymakers. It's like a disco. But it's about the only place you could put bands on. It didn't really suit having bands on. But I remember the gig, and actually, we were pretty good by then. We'd actually got our thing pretty together. Nightingales were really good in the fall. They were like the super group of that. It wasn't really a scene, was it? But just kind of bands that didn't fit in anywhere. And the fall was like the super group of it. And they sounded really good. And they're bit more professional. They had a sound guy, somebody like a roadie. It's like, wow, this is like a proper band.
It didn't say much, did it? It was exactly in their own private plane, was it? Duncan driving the van and a 15-year-old getting some guitar strings out.
I know, but that's what it's like, wasn't it? You know, I always remember that. I never forget that. You know, when I meet young bands and that, and they're from small towns, I know how outsider you are. You know, people always say, why don't you put your own record out? It's really easy. And I say, well, it's not actually. No, it's all right if you live in Manchester or London. You kind of know people. But if you're in Grimsby, you're on hiding to nothing. Mm-hmm. It's really difficult. Even with the internet there, it's really tough to get your stuff out there or to even know what you're doing and how to do it. You know, it's so I've always been very aware of that. So to us, it would seem amazing that somebody had gear that worked or a roadie or a drive.
That's interesting, that, because I would have thought these days it didn't really matter where you came from. Is that not, you don't think that's true?
It's probably easier now than it used to be because you can look stuff up and you can get connected online and that, but you still don't have that random thing. You know, if you go to gigs around Manchester for about a year, you get to meet people you didn't even know existed who can help you along in the bands, and that's fine. I have no problem with it. That's how it should be for everybody. It's just, I know if you're in Grimsby, it ain't going to be that easy. You can go to about one gig every 3 months because hardly anybody ever plays up there, you know, and it's, you do get isolated. Yeah. One advantage of being isolated is that you just get on with your own thing and there's no one to copy, and there's not actually any, you don't try and do it to get anywhere because there's no point. You're not going to get anywhere. So you just play music for the sheer joy of it, and it ends up completely warped, which is basically what we did, you know. We were trying to make music that was normal, but we had no idea how to do it. So we just ended up making music that sounded exactly like us.
Yeah, we're the same, I think.
Which is pure, but it's completely useless, isn't it? Because there's only a few people ever going to be interested in listening to it.
With the best will in the world, I don't think we could have sounded like anybody else because it didn't have the skills to sound like anybody else.
In a way, that's
we didn't have the skills to copy anybody, no.
I think that's one of the things that's interesting about the fall, and it was almost like a small town band in a big city, wasn't it? That's why we felt a similarity with it. We felt these aren't that far away from us, but there was like a few more musical skills because you can hear on the bass, you know, there are proper bass drums on that. When I learned about them, I thought, oh, is that how they did that bit? So like Totally Wired has that really cool running it, which is, we wouldn't know how to do that. We didn't know you could do things like that.
Pete Oak knows how to do it. He does it on transmission.
Yeah, you see, like,
it's the same notes. It's the same notes. I mean, I'm not saying anybody ripped anybody else off because they're all both about the same time. But transmission, transmission and Totally Wired, the bass are exactly the same notes.
But that's see that always. sort of shows that music isn't just the notes, it's about the atmosphere it creates.
That's right, yeah.
Because they're completely different songs, aren't they? I mean, yeah. You can have all the... Yeah. It's like, you know, when Led Zeppelin sued, what they called, that band on the West Coast. I know that band on the West Coast sued Led Zeppelin for Stairway to Heaven, but what they hadn't realised is Stairway to Heaven has sold 30 million copies because it isn't just a riff. You know?
That's right, yeah, of course. Yeah.
A bit more they brought into it as well. And it might just be Jimmy Page's hair that sold 30 million records, but that is part of pop culture, isn't it? You know?
It is. I mean, you know, it's the old blockbuster... Gene Genie blues record, because they're completely different records, aren't they? But it's the same riff.
To say, well, they both nicked it off the same place. But what's going
to be off somebody else? Yeah, apparently.
They both nicked it on the same day.
I can't remember. Now, someone told me what it was called. It's a blues, sort of 60s blues kind of.
Oh yeah, yeah. It's a really famous riff. But it's gone off the top of my head. I've got the original somewhere, but it's. I like them both. I don't see when I was growing up with glam rock, I had no idea that David Bowie was really cool and the Suite weren't meant to be cool. I just thought they're both completely cool and amazing. You know, the idea that the Suite looked like brickies in drag is bizarre to me because Brian Connolly looked amazing. He looked like Brian Jones from the 70s. He looked like the coolest rock star. And he actually, to us, when we were super young, he looked cooler than David Bowie. I had no idea which one was cool, which one wasn't because I was so young. And I had nobody to check notes with. So now when I interview people, they go, Starman was the moment, you know, and it's got all this culture. You just read that in a book. When you were 12, you thought, oh, Starman, oh, that's great glam rock song, Mud. Oh, look, Tiger Feet's great. You didn't.
Yeah.
And there was nothing, you couldn't read this stuff up anywhere and crib all this information. What's like Roxy Music, I really like Roxy Music, but I didn't know they were the cool bands.
I had an older brother, so I was quite, you know, kind of lucky in that respect because they kind of point you as to what's cool and what's not. I mean, you can make your own mind up eventually, but at least you've got a bit of a point about it. But the thing about that was, and it goes against this whole theory that in 1976, everyone was going, I'm so sick of shit music, Top of the Pops is now in the score.
No, that is
and it's such bollocks.
It?
It's such bollocks.
Yeah. Yeah, it was, wasn't it? I mean, punk in a sense, it wasn't really a reaction. It was just more good stuff, wasn't it? There had been a lull. Yeah. I remember I was mad on glam rock, and then there was only a couple of things, 75, 76, like Sparks were still good and a couple of bits of Bobs. And everything seemed to sort of, for when you're a teenager, 8 months is forever, and it seemed like it wasn't really records you liked. And then the first time I heard punk was at ice skating rink in Blackpool when they played the Pistols, Ramones and the Damned, and there was a massive fight.
Wow, a lot of fights are gigging them days.
So this is where you would hang out when you were 15 at an ice.
Yeah.
Of course, that's so Blackpool, isn't it? It wasn't like, you know, well, I was down the Roxy. No, I wasn't. I was skating in badly like all the other kids used to do because that's all there was to do.
Never got the hang of roller skating, I must admit. I was like a giraffe on roller skates, mate. There's a roller skating rink here.
It's ice skating.
Ultra
had an ice hockey team that used to play Blackpool. Yes. That's how I knew that. So they both had this.
Still going.
Well, the Blackpool one's gone now, but it's rough. It wasn't like John Curry. It was like really rough down there. People, there'd be loads of fighting and blood on the ice. And, you know, like teenagers in the 70s, that was what people did, just fight each other and everyone else would hide in the corner thinking, oh, God.
I mean, that is a cliche as well, but that one is true. It was a rough place. Going out in 1978, 79, you weren't quite taking your life in your hands, but it wasn't far off.
It was, especially if you were dressed punk. I mean, going out.
Blackpool
in our Oxfam punk outfits was.
But they were all Oxfam, weren't they? I think in the north. I don't think anybody was wearing Vivian Westwood. I don't think so. Anyway,
I remember a kid turned up in the Vivian Westwood top, and he looked really out of place. I mean, I think her stuff's amazing, and they're more like works of art than clothes. But and I think and they do look incredible. Mm. But it didn't work in the north. It looked too. It almost looked tacky. But in London, it would make complete sense. In the north, it was all Oxfam, and it was like. Getting trousers and taking them in. I had to learn to stitch, take the trousers in to make them into drain pipes. I used to wear pinstripes all the time.
Yeah.
Because it's all D-mob suits and bank manager suits and chucked into Oxfam. I mean, so I didn't like jeans. I didn't want to wear blue jeans. So that would that. So if you didn't want to wear blue jeans, there wasn't anything you had to go to.
No. You can always get a decent, you can always get a decent jacket from Oxfam or whatever. But the Kecks were always, they're always a funny cut. I seem to remember there was like a massive zips and a.
Yeah. We had to take them in with a needle and thread, and they would never get the right shape. But they didn't really, as long as they weren't flared, it didn't matter what the rest of the shape was.
Yeah. So two years early, my man was putting little triangle wedges in his Steve's jeans to make them wider, and then it was content. The Kecks, it wish you make it bleeding mind up.
Oh, no, I remember that. I remember a kid at school turned up in the term 76 term, whatever it was. He had the biggest knotted tie ever, massive collars on his shirt, flares that like went way past his feet, long sets part in there, and he thought he was the king. And then Punk turned up about 4 weeks later. But only for about three people, because that's the other thing, it was very few people into it. Now when you see documentaries, they talk about this massive thing that swept the nation and everyone got into it. It was just like a few very timid kids got into it who really shouldn't have been getting into something that was that dangerous.
Yeah, that's right. It was kind of sort of, without reminding, it was kind of the weirdos who got into punk, I think, wasn't it, I think?
It's such a weird mixture, when it's like the kids who were too smart to be at school, really, weirdos, leftovers. It was people who were obsessed with pop culture as well, which is quite weird as well at the time, because I guess it's like now, isn't it? I mean, there'll be a few people into music and whoever else into cars or whatever. You don't want normal heads are into and stuff. And music was everything for us.
It was obsessive. I mean, you're looking about the copies of the NME that sold and the Melody Maker and Sounds, three weekly full-size newspapers. They were selling like, how many, half a million copies each or something?
Yeah, they're
people were obsessed with music.
I think they're more closer to about 100, 120,000 each, but still a lot. You've forgotten Record Mirror and Disc as well. Yeah. So there's five just before punk and things. Record Mirror was really good, actually. I met someone from Record Mirror the other day, and it was, you know, I was remembering how good they were at covering punk. It was like the pop paper with disco, but they had really good punk writers, and they used to get really good stuff in there. So the Melody Maker never really covered punk, did it? It was always a bit of an awkward relationship with Melody Maker.
No, a bit later on it did.
It did later on, but it was too late. And I thought the Sounds were really good. Sounds had John Savage and people like that. And for that period before it sort of went more of the Oi thing, it was really good on punk and post-punk. Dave McCulloch, he was a really good writer.
Even Gary Bushell, before he went nuts and started covering Oi, like you say, even his stuff was all right early on, I think.
Yeah, he was okay. I mean, I know Bushell, he's actually an all right guy, you know him. And I mean, I don't go into all the other stuff or whatever people want to say, but if you meet him as a geezer in a place. If you talk about music, it's great. He's just a massive fan. Yeah. He still loves music, and he talks about it in a really passionate way. So, that's all I'm interested
hated
in.
The fall.
Like that.
Hated the fall.
Yeah, he wouldn't. Tony wouldn't get it, would he? But there was also the politics of the paper, because him and David Culloch were the two young hot writers who were in competition with each other, weren't they? So at one point, they both remember they both covered the Clash together. They did one review where they both wrote the review together. They were like, they used to go out, they used to be mates together, but it was interesting where punk splintered and they kind of went down different paths, but they start in the same place, don't they? So it was all the Clash, and then within a year it's the Fall versus the Cotton Rejects or whatever, isn't it?
Yeah.
But the Cotton Rejects
was probably too far the other way then, because he was obsessed with the Fall.
Yeah, he was, wasn't he? Yeah. He's dead now, which is like nobody
I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's really sad. I just found it on the internet. Yeah.
I was just reading that this morning. Yeah. I mean, I knew already, but he's 55 when he died.
Quite a long time ago, wasn't it? Yeah. So, I mean, he's quite instrumental in documenting that post-punk stuff. I mean, he interviewed us, actually.
Yeah.
He came up to Blackpool to interview us in about 1980.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
But everybody came to Blackpool to interview these. We did a few pieces. It was always couched in Blackpool. So it was all about the lights, the tower, you know, and candy floss is always mentioned. And it's like, well, we're not able to do that. We don't even live in that part of the town. It's just kind of odd. I mean, that was part of it. Wasn't part of our culture. Section 25 had the same thing. You end up being candy floss post punk, you know, but a bit like Manchester's got the serious stuff, and Blackpool's got these kind of silly bands.
Right. I thought Section 25 being particularly hilarious. Whenever I heard him,
he did have a very sly sense of humour, Larry. I mean, he was funny, but. A visionary. I just think that first album is still mind blowing to this day. Martin Hannett's best production, the sound of it. Did you know Kanye West sampled one of the tracks about 3 years ago?
No.
Section 25, they sent me an email saying, Kanye West has just said, can he sample one of our tracks? What should we do? And I was going, What would you mean? What should you do? The answer is just yes.
Check his phone.
It was a whole track. He didn't just sample a bit, it's a whole song. He duets with Larry. In the track, and Larry's been dead 10 years. It's a very spooky track, but it's great. But it's also how, the drummer had
makes, this, you, makes you think. How did Kanye West hear a Section 25 song?
Well, listen to. I know he's a lunatic, but apparently he sits there and he listens to everything. He doesn't have a team of people looking for stuff. So his thinking would have been Joy Division, coolest band, very cool British band. But who are the other bands on that label? Joy Division is too obvious. So that's how I reckon he found Section 25. Yeah. But also the drummer, Vinny, in Section 25, he has this kind of loping death disco beat, which suits hip-hop. So the beat's like dum ba-da, ba-dum ba-da. And it's a perfect kind of slow hip-hop beat. So in the track, it totally suits Kanye. It's amazing.
Fantastic.
And they got the payday. So that was really good. I mean, they must have got 40. It's a number one album in America. So they must have got, I hope they got a lot of money. I'm sure they did.
I hope so.
Yeah.
So it could happen to you one day, couldn't it? The Fall Green.
Yeah, I'm up at Jay-Z. Well, I was a sample totally mine one of these days.
Can't be that one, Paul.
There's so many.
Carry on, Tolly Wilde. Yeah, I've never mentioned that.
But the other tracks, and I always gone about the Fall Groove, but that perfect swing that you have on your bass, Steve, that thing we just play one riff forever and ever, and it just really swings in a really kind of weird way. I mean, I could totally
loads
of hip hop tracks could use something like that because it does have a groove. The Fall are a groovy band.
Oh, be my guest.
you don't want me to do it. You'll probably lose money on that.
Next time you're speaking to Beyonce, see if she'll fancy sampling.
It's a hot aftershave pop.
That's getting put in front of these people. I think maybe not enough people concentrate on the music of the Fall. I mean, obviously, Mark's persona was so powerful, you know, and so captivating. Mm. But people sort of tend to overlook the music. Not everybody, but... You know, so they only go to him, but there's actually a whole thing going on there, which I hope the new bands kind of reminds people of.
No, I often did think that, but if you go on YouTube and you if you're sad enough, if you go on YouTube and you look at the comments underneath, there's always a lot of like good stuff about the music.
Oh yeah, I think the fans get it. Yeah. I mean, beyond the fans of the band, you know, the general idea of what the band is to people who don't really get the records, but you know that it's more about the persona of the singer more than the band in that kind of world, isn't it? So we all get it and stuff, and I'm not in the band, so I can perfectly say that I think the Fall Groove is fantastic and I can big it all up because it has no advantage to me at all, does it?
No. Sorry, Steve.
I was just gonna say, when did you actually move to Manchester?
83. Yeah, because we're trying to get it going in Blackpool. We're trying to make a scene there. But it's every summer when the Grockles came back, you got kicked out of all the clubs and the pubs, so we couldn't put gigs on in the summer because they didn't want to put the 100 acres off. They didn't want all the weirdos in there. When I say all, about 100 of us. And then I did go to Polytechnic. I went to North Staffs Polys. I was at Stafford for about a year, though I never actually went to anything. So I was down there for a bit, and then I went back for about 8 months, and then I just came over to Manchester. Because you're just getting impossible to do stuff in Blackpool, you know. I mean, I still go back now and then. I'm still really fond of the place, but you're not going to get a musical thing going in them days from there. And we used to go to Manchester for gigs. We just want to go and see bands play. We couldn't. It was a major expedition to go and see a band then, whereas Manchester, when I got here, of course, I mean, it wasn't like I'd get bands every night. It was about one a week, but at least you could get to that gig.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, well, the Hacienda was open every night then, wasn't it? I mean, we didn't have bands on that often. But so you actually moved as a sort of, well, career is probably the wrong word, but so to be in a band in Manchester, that was the motivation for moving, was it?
No, I was already in the band. We just moved half the band over here. So,
right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, so I mean, but I mean, to further your career as a musician, if you
just to be able to go out. it wasn't really that cynical thinking, oh, we could go over there and we'd have a career, because you don't think about music as a career, do you? Because you can't, can you? Especially when you're making music, it's fairly obtuse. You just make the stuff. And I mean, it's not like you put it out and hope, no, you hope everyone will be into it and you do everything you can to make people listen to it. But it's not like thinking, you know what, if I make a record that's a bit like that, so it's going to be great for my sales projections. I mean, maybe that's the way we should have thought about it, you know?
I mean, we could have thought like that, yeah, no. But you don't, though,
do
you?
No,
you really don't. No.
So when did you sign to Intake then, John?
That would be later on. We were on a label called Criminal Damage. It was like a little sort of gothy type label from Reading. And then we were going to be the first release on Creation. And McGee came up to the studio to hear us record Spike Miglin's tape recorder. And he was going to sign us before that. I was friends with
him. Was it?
Put him off, yeah. But I was friends with Alan McGee before he had Creation Records, so we're really good friends. And then we were on Creation, then we had a big fallout, and then we went to Intake, and I think that was about 86.
Oh, yeah. Classic timing.
Yeah.
It's amazing how, you know, influential. Like, obviously, it's your mate's label. I never thought, you know, never really figured on my. I mean, we were the first thing on Intake, weren't we, Steve?
We were.
Yeah. But he didn't really work out that label.
Didn't go down too well, but.
No, I got told off for that.
But it was the time we joined, it was a really good roster. I mean, it was like,
yeah,
it was kind of collecting up all those bands, wasn't it? If the Three Johns and the Nightingales had been on there as well, it would have been, it would have been the Empire. It would have had the whole caboodle, the whole gang, wasn't it? This basically all the C86 bands who didn't get on C86.
Yeah, I mean,
who actually pioneered it for about 4 years. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yes, and it was good that it was up here as well. That was handy. Yeah. So you could actually go around to the house, you know, because it wasn't like when you're on other, like, labels before, they're in London. It was a bit of a, you could never meet the label. You're like an outlier. Yeah.
Yeah. I didn't realise that. I was talking to James Brown, and he was, you know, he knew all the Intake people because he used to play football with Mark.
Well, I introduced him because I knew James first. So he turned up at our gigs in Leeds first time I met him. He's about 16 with his little bag of fanzines. He just started it then. And then he'd come over to Manchester and stay at our house. And I introduced him to the people that I knew. So that's how he got to know. He knew John Langford as well already, but then I hooked him up with Mark and all those people. Yeah, so, I mean, that's what James has always done in a good way, you know, just become mates of mates. I've seen him in the week. He came up to Louder Words. I hadn't seen him for such a long time.
Oh, I saw it, yeah.
Yeah, and we had really good fun as well, just like it was back when we, when he was a kid. I wasn't really a kid then, but like back in the old days, fanzine days, when we were all going to change the world. Yeah,
you did. Well, he did.
Yeah,
he did. Loaded changed the world. I'm not so sure it was for the better, but that was. If you get into that whole thing of that lad culture that started then, and, you know, I'm not sure he wouldn't.
It was interesting, wasn't it? Because that was sort of half of it when he did Loaded, but the other half of Loaded was still Attack on Bazaar. It still had really good articles in it. It was still quite, it was still really funny. And those bits I was more interested in, you know, that was a bit that was, well, just because I'm more interested in that stuff. And they'd have really, they would have really weird curveball things that you wouldn't expect in there as well. So it wasn't like nuts. It had a bit more to it, really, didn't it?
Yeah, it did. I'm not for a minute saying that that was, you know, down to him or it was anything that he encouraged even particularly, but that it just that the time of the time when you had Loaded and then you had Britpop and then suddenly everyone who would never talk about football was suddenly talking about football. It was a strange time. It was kind of transitional time, that, wasn't it? I suppose it was Labour as well.
Yeah, it was, and it's, I know it's fashionable to look to poo-poo it now, look down on it, because there's always that thing that if stuff's popular, it obviously can't be as good. But you know what?
Yes.
I mean, it was good to see Pulp after all those years of slogging around and beating. They supported us a few times. I remember they would play a gig and think, "Oh God, not Pulp! They don't pull anybody." You know when you're, you know you're a circuit band, you need a support band to bring 50 in to help get the gig up to 150. Yeah. Then you go, "You're not got any friends." And then about a month later, they're the biggest band in the country, and I thought that was such a heartwarming story. And it didn't really, they didn't really change what they did that much, you know. And it's, but I knew all the bands in that Britpop thing that got big, and you know. The music was actually more, like nowadays people go, "Oh, it's so simplistic." But when you think about it, Blur, there's, there's quite a big dose of the Fall and Blur, isn't there? You know, it's,
oh, there is, yeah, definitely, yeah.
It is another,
I mean, and Pulp as another, well, I mean, I think.
There's another thing you the Hanley brothers should do is get yourself on a Gorillaz track. Why don't you just approach it? Because there's where the Fall Groove should go. Oh. Now I've got it, I've worked out your career now. Is the next Gorillaz album.
We've been crying out for a manager, John. This is the manager made.
We'll leave it with you,
Well, I'm actually thinking of a favour for Damon Albarn because he's a Fall fan. And what could be better than having the classic rhythm section playing on a track, doing the Fall groove? You know, it'd just be so perfect. It's so perfect. I can't see how that wouldn't work.
Well, it's a question we've often asked ourselves, isn't it, Paul?
Well, I'm giving you the answer.
I've got a good quote from you about the Fall Groove. One of the greatest sounds known to the human race is the Fall Groove. Heavy-duty, bass-driven, willful, grinding repetition that the band would lock into at their highest peak. And then, of course, Mark Riley moved over on the guitar, didn't he?
Mark was good on bass, but his guitar was better. There's spinning the glide, really catchy. Good songwriter as well. But the classic classic Fall groove is on the other end of this call. You know, that's I think where Steve would just lock in on the bass and look completely intense is the core of the trunk actually of the band for years, wasn't it? And it was almost like Mark would be playing off that in a way, wouldn't he? And I always like that thing you always told me, Steve, about standing sideways on the stage so he couldn't get anywhere near your ramp. And now every time I look at a picture of the Fall, in that period, I think,
you're
standing sideways.
It's like he's wearing the cap on his back, isn't it? He's that close to it.
In looking back, it's done me quite well because I've only got one bad ear.
The bass is worse for ears than guitars, isn't it?
I think so. I've got one deaf ear, because Steve was to my left. I can't hear a bloody thing in my left ear now.
God, I've been really lucky. Mine are all right. I can't understand why. Because we were loud, you know. One of my guitar players had to retire because of tinnitus, and then it's never affected me. I've never really been that careful with them either. So it's just luck, isn't it?
Well, I've started wearing earplugs now, which I find is a bit ridiculous because
you turn up.
Everybody turns up, but if everybody just played a bit quieter, then we'd be away. But no, but I got away with it for a long time because I've, touch wood, I've never had tinnitus, and it's an awful affliction, isn't it? Tinnitus, if you get it bad.
I think everybody's got it, but it's just a very.
I've got it, yeah.
It's low level.
It's not too bad, but yeah, I've definitely got it.
People get it to that level where they can't sleep, like my guitar player.
Yeah.
Chris Elm out of the Seahorses, he had it. I remember talking to him, and he used to have to detune the TV. Unless it put white noise on to get to sleep because it was tinnitus was that bad.
Because your mind gets distracted from the tinnitus, doesn't it? Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
My missus has got it a little bit. She has white noise on her phone, but she never fails to remind me that of the unfairness of life, that she's got tinnitus and I...
The unfairness of life. I know, it's funny.
Right, so we need to do the favour of talking about your new book, your new goth book.
We only go around plugging stuff. But we can.
I just wanted to see, to get your opinion on the contrast between those two scenes that kind of grew up at the same time. So you had Joy Division and The Fall, and then the goth scene style, which on paper would be polar opposites, but they kind of rubbed along quite nicely together in a lot of ways.
Well, in the book, I mean, the basic premise of the book is called The Art of Darkness, which is about... It's kind of like every generation's reaction to melancholic vibe of Europe, you know, the damp grey sky. So whether it was building a Gothic cathedral or romantic poets or you know, paintings, so that's all in there as well. But the music bit is the main chunk of the book, of course. But it isn't just the classic goth bands. I stretch it out much wider because the other premise of the book was it's about what is going to a goth club in 79, 80, when it wasn't even called goth, it was just alternative clubs, really. And it's the music they played in there. So like, you know, as time went on, you know, they were playing Sister Mercy. I love Sister Mercy. I mean, you speak to Andrew Eldritch, and he actually calls it, he said he always called it the M62 sound. So he felt a kinship with The Fall and Joy Division and the Bunnymen and the Teardrop Explodes. He felt that was the scene, which it kind of was.
They're not a million miles apart.
But you go in those clubs and they would play The Fall. Hit the North was always in those clubs. And it didn't seem out of place. Birthday Party. I mean, I know everybody hates the term, and Nick Cave will run a mile from being called a goth, but his audience was a goth audience. But he's also, he crossed over into The Fall. There's always, and he's the same people. I mean, you know, people always say it's very tribal then, in a sense it was, but in a sense it wasn't. You know, you could like all these different things at the same time. John Peel played them all. It wasn't like he wasn't allowed to play just because they were called goth or something. I mean, Southern Deathcore, massively influenced by Joy Division. The Fall crop up in the book a few times. You know, I did a little...
Well, that Long Mac Brigade was kind of the bit in the middle between The Fall and Joy Division. And I think there's real elements of goth in Joy Division.
Yeah, well, they were one of the first bands to be called goth or gothic. I mean, the first band to be called goth was The Doors, got reviewed in 1967 at their first New York gig, and they were called a gothic band. And then there's a bit of a gap until it crops up again, and the word gets used for Joy Division by Martin Hannett in about really early on, 78, 79. So what it becomes, it's like punk, isn't it? I mean, people's idea of what punk is now isn't what it was at the time. But the weird thing about goth was it's a retrospective term for a scene that was already there, because they were just called alternative clubs. It's the alternative scene. Mm. And goth was a piss take term stuck on afterwards by the music press. But it's actually quite an interesting term because it does tie all in with Lord Byron, with Gothic architecture, and the book starts with the fall of Rome getting sacked by the Visigoths, which is where a music book should always start, shouldn't it?
Of course, yes, indeed, yeah. If you ask now, there was fucking thousands at that fall of Rome. They weren't actually there, were they? They're only pretending.
The clubs are just full of Visigoths, waving axes around with horned helmets. And then the fall had that phase where they actually looked a bit like a goth band when Mark used to do that big triumph belt and have the eyeliner on and stuff like that, you know, when Brix was sort of dressing them up a bit. So he could have almost passed for being a goth band, which is kind of interesting. Well, it's still slagging off Julian Cope, though, running for having a flying jacket.
So that's the thing. Do you manage to define what goth bands sound like? Because it's quite a broad church, isn't it, I think?
I guess if you define it, there is a lurking darkness, and it's always a moping darkness. It can actually be quite tongue in cheek. There's a melancholia to it, to musical style, but also, very much like post punk, every instrument plays lead, which is a generalisation. But you know, the way that like in The Fall, the bass is a lead instrument, and the guitar is, and the drums, you can sing a lot of The Fall songs. I'm not saying The Fall are classic goth band because they're not, but you can sing the drum lines in your head. Yeah. And that's what I liked in that period, because everybody played lead all at once. Everybody played something completely different at the same time, and it worked. And that's kind of a loose thing you can apply to most of the bands across the scene. So they always had bass players who played like lead bass, didn't they? That was quite important. And singers who couldn't technically really sing, but somehow made it work, you know, which is very punk as well, isn't it?
Yeah.
But I put more of a deeper voice version of it, more of a attempt at the baritone version of it.
Yeah, the ultimate goth record for me, and I think it's got a humour in it that a lot of people don't pick up on. I was talking to somebody, we were talking about Rafters, and Bill Lou Goes He's Dead, I think is just the best record. And there's a film of him doing it on Riverside or something, and it is hilarious the way he plays up this sort of vampire thing. I think that's nobody's playing rhythm there. That's like four lead instruments, and then him giving it about the count. I love that record.
It's an amazing record. I mean, Bauhaus, I mean, are to me an incredible band. Like, they're one of the greatest art rock bands this country ever produced, but the music press detests them. So they get written out of the narrative. So when they talk about music from like the early 80s, they're never included, even though they're really influential, but also really imaginative. Every single song was completely different. But the story behind, I was just doing the Bauhaus chapter yesterday, just editing it, and it reminded me of the story of it. And they formed, so Daniel Asher, Pete Murphy had one rehearsal, then they get the other two guys in the week after. They wrote Bela Lugosi in the second rehearsal because, you know, they had a bit of a bass line. He did some dub things on his guitar. The bass player, David Jay, gave Peter Murphy the lyrics. He sort of crooned over top. So they said, that sounds good. Let's go and do a demo. So the week after that, they did the demo of it, and that's the single. So they'd only be going, and they'd be going 4 weeks when they recorded Bela Lugosi. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
It's become a timeless classic, and it's an incredible piece of music. The first thing we put out was 8 minutes long, dark dub with songs about an old actor. You think, why ain't going to work? Can you imagine trying to do that with a proper record label?
Well, when we first got a video recorder, we used to tape any bit of music with on the TV, and that was one of the first things we had, was Bela Lugosi Dead on Riverside. And I must have watched it a million times. It's on YouTube now, obviously, but it's fantastic.
Oh, Riverside.
It's so ridiculous and so over the top and pulling on faces, and it's fantastic. And what a brilliant record.
It's very theatrical, but it's also very... And it's funny as well. It's got a dark humour, but it's also genuinely quite dark and quite scary, so it works on every level. I think Daniel Ash is one of the greatest guitar players this country's ever produced. He never plays anything that complex. He doesn't do solos or riffs. He just makes these really cool noises with the guitar. He uses an Evo and like a little reverb unit. And everything he does is really imaginative. He does, I know this sounds a bit poncy, but he does guitar stuff that is like a painting, like daubs of paint.
A bit like Keith Levine, God rest his soul.
Oh, Keith was an amazing guitar player as well. I mean, there's a whole raft of great guitar players. I mean, John Mackay at the Banshees, there's an intake record.
He was
That Zorga Moore record.
Of course, yeah, I read that the other day. Yeah, they were on intake. This band, I can't remember what they were called now.
Zorga Moore.
That's the ones, I didn't realise that was John McGough.
It's one of the great lost classics. If this book does anything, it will get people to go and listen to that track. So I went down such a rabbit hole on that song, because I remember when it came out on the intake, and they just couldn't get it played, couldn't get anything with it, could they? But it's just like, because the guy who drummed for Zorga Moore actually got in touch when I put it on Facebook. So I drummed on that, and he said there was a feeling in the music business that they were still blaming John Mackay breaking up the Banshees, so he had all this negative vibe going on, and he's one of the greatest guitar players came out. In a way, that chiming glassy sound, he had it before Keith Levine. He probably is the source. I'm not doing down Keith, because Keith did amazing stuff. Keith, he used to get up and play the Membranes, Keith Levine. He played about 5 gigs with me. He'd just get on stage, and I say, can you just do the song in the middle? And he'd go, okay. And he wouldn't even want to rehearse it. He'd just get up and just play it, and he always got it right. And he's when you see the videos of it on YouTube, it's just us looking at them going, fuck, how does he do that?
I get the impression that the first lineup of Public Image Limited didn't spend a lot of their days rehearsing. I might be wrong.
No, that song obviously came together in 5 minutes and it's perfect. I mean that's the first bass line wobble ever made up, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, it's like hilariously first baseline-ish, but absolutely brilliant at the same time, isn't it?
Completely perfect. I mean, that's the thing about that point in time. People were doing things 4 weeks after forming. They weren't worrying about it for years and then trying to hone it down. They just went in and did it. And sometimes that didn't work, but when it worked, it's amazing, isn't it? It's about to crash, but it doesn't quite crash. And the energy of that.
Metal Box is all like that. Any minute now, this is going to fall to pieces. And it doesn't. It's just brilliant.
It's amazing. And the first album's amazing. You know, the one that people don't often, you know, people have looked at the fact it's Wobble First's first album, you know, and it's, you know, when you listen to it, because it's a bit more wall of sound, but it's still really effective, you know, it's, yeah, just incredible. Yeah. I mean, what a band. I mean, I even like Flowers of Romance. I thought that was a great record as well. It's, and it bits and bobs afterwards, but it's diminishing returns, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, the Flowers of Romance, I mean, I think the single's great. I'm not so sure the album holds quite up as much.
No. Go back. It's amazing. The drum sounds on that, you know, that first Four and Closed Walls, that snare sound on that, oh, God, it's incredible. It's so great. I like that period. You can't really, I mean, it's a bit of a dodgy word now. Tribal drum sounds is great, wasn't it? Like, and that, you know, with Adamant's two drummers, amazing. Kings of Alpha and Tear, love that record. That Brundy Beat thing was ace. Bow Wow, of course. And that Pill album was kind of a version of that, you know, that tribal pounding thing. That was Nick Laney. I always thought it was Nick Laney, but I found out it was... Steve Lillywhite is a person who started that drum sound, and he said he started putting it together on the Banshees' first album.
Using
the playback mic and mixing it with the snare coming out of it, putting it back in with the snare and gating it. And
Hugh, is that how you do it? All right, okay.
Well, that's how he started doing it. But in the end, they had it down to a science. So Peter Gabriel used it. But I tell you, used it really well was XTC on those middle albums.
Oh, bloody hell, what's it? Making Plans for Nigel.
Nigel, yeah.
Yeah, or
I've written about 50 times that drum beat.
But after that, when they did their Mumma on those records, you know, when they have those kind of African high life guitars, English folk sort of melodies, but these massive sort of pounding tribal drums. Because Terry Chambers, amazing drummer, you know,
powerhouse drummer.
You know, so it's in fact, you should get him on this podcast. He'd be really good. But it's those records are amazing. The drum sounds of those are some of the best drum sounds I've ever heard. I know we're getting a bit tech now, but it's music, isn't it? We are talking about music.
I'm a bit worried about getting a drummer on. I've been listening to two bass players for an hour. I'm a bit nervous about getting two drummers on.
Well, I love drums. It's my favourite instrument, but I've never been able to play. I could play along with people badly. But I can't drum like a proper drummer, but I always listen to drums. I appreciate drums.
Fair enough. Well, on that bombshell, I think we've reached an hour, John. I mean, we could talk for hours, but that's been a real pleasure to talk to you about that. And all the best wishes you there. And I wasn't bringing it up for the purposes of making more sales. I just really wanted to talk about that.
No, it's cool. It's an interesting period. But that's the other thing. You don't. I like writing about all that stuff, but I don't want to stay there forever. You know, you want to. What's happening next? You get to an age.
What are you doing next?
Well, we're going to do a tour of Chameleons that's coming up, and with some recording. But there's I'm still doing that Green Britain thing. We're trying to make all these courses for people, then eco courses. Teachers people like to do eco jobs, but. We're going to make there's quite a lot of interesting little things gone off that little angles and stuff. And then just talk to people about really weird ideas about gaming and stuff like that. Stuff that's kind of, it's pop culture, but different instead of, I could talk forever about XTC's drum sound. I like doing that. But I like to be, I like conversations about the future as well and stuff and different things, you know.
Keep up the good work. I must thank you, by the way, on behalf of me and Mike, for the whole of Manchester, for the Louder Than War Words weekend was fantastic. You and Jill,
it really was
brilliant. So what a gift to Manchester that is. You know, and it's very
great. It's always great having you involved every year as well. So we'll think of another version of your things. I want to expand it out, kind of make it bigger, because I think it could definitely get bigger. We're just trying to make some plans at the moment.
Well, I think the sky's the limit, but I think it was fantastic. Thanks very much for your time, as ever. Brilliant to speak to you. Don't forget to give Damon my phone number for the next Gorillaz album.
Just yours.
I'm gonna plant the idea in people in that little camp.
What percentage you want then, John? 2%, 3%? What
should cut? I just want it to happen. Yeah.
Right. Okay. Yeah. When Beyonce gets in touch, we'll keep that for ourselves.
Yeah.
All right. Good to speak to you, mate.
Thanks.
All the best.
Bye bye.
Thanks.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of Old Brother. The next episode will be released in 2 weeks. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Old Brother Show, where you can find links to our Spotify playlist. Or why not subscribe via iTunes, Stitcher or RSS, so you'll be all set for the rest of Series 3. You can also give us a rating on iTunes, subscribe on YouTube, or just tell your friends if you fancy it too. For further reading, our books about the fall, The Big Midweek and Ever Bleeding Guest, are available from Root Publishers and all good bookstores, where you can also find John's many fine tomes. If you are able to support Louder Than Words, please do, you won't regret it. Hope to speak to you all again soon, and remember, if you're driving, take your car. Ta-ra!
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.